So the work I'm going to talk about is a joint project with Jason Lucas from Tokyo, who is going to give a next talk, and Eduardo Martinez from Waterloo, and David Bruschi from Nottingham. And the question that we ask concern problems that were first discussed like 8 years ago in work by Yvette Fuentes and Rob Mann, the work that concerned how quantum state changes when non-inertial effects are taken into account. In particular, it's the question that they asked was, what happens if two observers share an entangled state, and this entangled state has been prepared in the absence of gravitational effects, and one of the observers is inertial, but the other one is non-inertial and undergoes some uniform acceleration. Or maybe is present in the proximity of a black hole, which is kind of similar, gives you a similar effect. Unfortunately, this work and further effort to improve it always relied on certain assumptions that were kind of difficult to interpret. For example, the states for simplicity were always global. The entangled state that we consider were always global states of global modes. And it has been realized a couple of years ago that actually the states that are necessary to interpret those results are so-called undermodes. Involve undermodes, which are not only global, but also very difficult to prepare. For example, an undermode in a finite region of space will oscillate infinitely many times. And it's like a plane wave that has been logarithmically shrunk to a finite region. And the question how to measure such a state and how actually interpret the results in the operational sense is it was quite difficult to answer. So we have tried to make an effort to make this analysis a little bit further and try to understand how can such measurements can be performed and how those results can be analyzed when the states that are analyzed are localized. And also we asked the question how these localized states could be measured by observers. It was actually very important to know the position of the observer and the position of the detector that makes measurements, because especially in curved spacetime or non-inertial frames of reference, where each position of the observer will correspond to different proper acceleration that he experiences. So it was very crucial to exactly know what is the position of the measuring apparatus and how the process of measurement takes place. So. Not only us were working on this problem, also Tim Ralph independently developed a different approach to this problem, and he'll talk about it later. What we have studied is relying on a very simple quantum optical setup. We all know that there are several problems concerning measurements in quantum field theory. Some of them were already discussed, and there are also more. However, it's also known that there are working operational schemes that can be used in quantum optics that describe measurement procedures properly, and they are also used in experiments, and they work. And we also expect that if those relativistic effects, like Unruh effect, can be seen by detectors like the Unruh-Debye detector, they should also be seen by all types of other detectors. If the effect is real, we should be able to see it with all types of detection schemes. And why don't we like to use Unruh-Debye detectors that are kind of commonly used to study these problems? The problem with Unruh-Debye detectors is that, well, there are several problems that concern those detectors. One of them is that they don't give you a direct insight into the state of the field. You have to use an atom that is playing a role of like a carrier that you have to couple to the field, wait a little bit, and then read out the state of the atom. This method can be also misleading because there are some effects that can cause the transition of the atom even in the absence of the particles in the field. For example, finite time of interaction will always give you such effect. And what we are interested in is to study what is the instantaneous state of the field at a given moment, as good as it can be studied, because we know that there are some limits impossible to cross. You can't limit the times of observation interactions as short as you want, because you'll run into problems with quantum mechanics. So the model that we have that has inspired us is a quantum optical model of detection of a single mode of light. Light is a perfect example of relativistic quantum field, and in this case, the whole scheme consists of a lens, single mode fiber, and a detector that counts single photons. So suppose you have a field that contains many modes, and these modes have different occupations, and there is some unknown state of each of the modes, and you would like to measure one particular mode of light. And, for example, you could ask the question, what is the number of photons in that particular mode? So what you can do is you can use a lens to focus that mode onto the tip of a single mode fiber. And the single mode fiber is this funny device that has this property that it only carries one particular transverse mode of light. So if you couple a Gaussian mode, a mode that has a Gaussian profile, in the transverse direction, this mode will propagate through the fiber, but all the other shapes that are orthogonal to that Gaussian, including even those that have a Gaussian envelope but have a different phase, will not be carried through the fiber, it will just scatter. The fiber will only carry the single mode of light. Therefore, out of all the possible modes, this one mode will be filtered out by this lens and the tip of the fiber, and through here there will be this one mode propagating to the detector, and it can be attached to this single mode detector that is working as a photodiode avalanche, and the detector will give you information about how many photons were in that mode. In the ideal version of this scheme, you can think of all the other modes to be completely scattered here, or you can think of this device to be transparent to the other modes. So in the idealized version, only this one mode will be detected here, and all the others will just go through unaffected by the whole process. There are several important issues concerning this model. One of them that is extremely important is that this detection is not instantaneous. It takes finite time, and this finite time cannot be limited beyond, cannot be lowered below a certain limit. Well, we can always make this part of the fiber very short, so the time of transition from here to here can be always reduced. But what cannot be reduced is the time of filtering, the time that light has to take, that takes the light to come from here to here. And this finite time is, as you can see, proportional to the size of the mode that you measure. So one of the inevitable consequences of this approach is that the measurement will always take finite time, and this finite time will be proportional to the size of the mode that you are going to measure, and this actually leads to very interesting consequences. For example, there was this problem discussed by Benny Verznik yesterday, the problem raised by Rafael Sorkin, that basically shows that if you have localized measurements in one region of space-time and localized measurements in the other region of space-time, and those regions are space-like separated, so they are closely disconnected, if you introduce a third local measurement that has some causal contact with the previous measurement and has some influence on the further measurement, you can show that this measurement will affect that measurement, and that would lead to problems with causality, that would lead to supraluminal signaling. However, as you can see in this case, the measurement that we take into account is not instantaneous, it takes finite time, and this finite time is actually proportional to the size of the mode, so the measurement maybe is projective, because what we do here is we actually project onto the Fock space of this one selected mode, but it takes finite time, and in space-time, it's not represented by a by a segment, it's represented by a square. That means that if you want to redraw the whole scheme with squares, if you have one measurement that's represented by a square, another one that is represented by a square, which means that here the filtering procedure starts and here you have a final state, then in order to, if these measurements are outside, they're outside each other light cones, you will never be able to introduce a third measurement in between, that is also a square, if you want to keep this causal structure. And if you take into account the finite time of interaction, you see that all the problems raised by Sorkin will be gone, because you just, if you introduce the first square, this one has to be shifted here, and now they are in causal contact already, so the whole paradox is gone. And as far as I know, I'm not aware of any physical process that would allow you to make measurements that are faster than a certain time. And this is just an example. So this process that takes place here is this process of photon detection. It's described by quantum optical photon detection interaction that involves electrons that are kicked out by impinging photons, and this is a standard quantum optical phenomenon. And we can effectively describe what's going on here by a set of projective operators onto the Fock space of this one mode of light. Then we only analyze the state of the detector after the state has been detected, but we never ask the question, what is the state of the field after the detection? Why is that? Simply because the photons have been absorbed here, and in this case, we have no idea what is, well, the fields are absorbed, and you can say that the state of the field has been destroyed, and there is no point asking what is the state after. How has it been projected? Of course, knowing the outcome of the measurements, you can always prepare a new state that is exactly the same with the one that you have measured, but it's already a different issue. So we never discuss what happens with the state of the field. We only ask what is the outcome of the classical outcome of the detection. And as I said before, our detector is only sensitive to only one mode of light. In this case, this is a Gaussian mode. But if you place a filter here in front that transforms one mode into the other, you can, in principle, select any mode you want and detect number of photons in that mode with this setting. And what we do, we are inspired by this example, and we consider an idealized version of the detector that measures some abstract quantum field. We consider massless scalar fields that is able to make a projection in one selected mode of that field. We actually, in the detection process, we will not in detail focus on the time that it takes for the detection to be completed. We effectively then describe the whole process with a set of projective operators, but we always keep in mind that, in principle, the whole process will have to take a finite time to be finished. So, what we assume about the mode that we want to observe with our detector model is that this mode has to be localized. It has to have a finite size. Not necessarily localized to a compact support, actually. We don't want it to be localized to a compact support. We allow for some tails, and we actually consider some Gaussian tails for the reasons I'm going to discuss later. We want this mode to be small, especially when we go to a non-linear frame of reference when there is an event horizon, and we don't want the mode to be too large, we don't want the mode to be too close to the event horizon, and we don't want the tail to penetrate the event horizon. So we can use safe cylinder coordinates and actually assume, when the mode has a small size, the proper time in each part of the detector is approximately the same if the mode is localized around one particular trajectory. And one of the most important assumptions is that we want our mode only to contain positive frequencies. positive frequencies in respect to a reference frame that is co-moving with the detector. For example, if our detector is in rest, we want the mode that it measures only to contain positive Minkowski frequencies. If the detector is uniformly accelerated, we want the detector to see only the modes that are that consist of positive Rinder frequencies, etc. Obviously, then, what is positive frequency in one frame that does not necessarily have to be positive frequency in the other frame of reference, and that's the whole point behind the Unruh effect that we are going to reveal with this type of detection. So, it is well known in quantum optics how to describe that detection in the inertial frame of reference. What is not clear is how to do it when such a detector is accelerating. What is going to change? So suppose that you have a detector that is able to see a given mode that you select, say it's a Gaussian or whatever, and you can ask your question, what this detector is going to see when you take it and make it accelerate uniformly? And we were thinking about that, we found that it's useful to use the following analogy with a cavity. For example, if you take a cavity that is in the rest, you know very well what are the eigenmodes of the cavity. They are just sine functions if the cavity is ideal. And it's also known what happens if you accelerate the cavity. You can also find the solutions, and those solutions look like gravitationally shifted, Doppler shifted eigenmodes of the resting cavity. So effectively, you find that instead of a sine function, you find something like a logarithmically shrunk sine function. And the point is that we exactly know what's going on with the mode of the cavity when it accelerates, how the mode changes. So we assume that actually the mode that we consider undergoes the same transformation, undergoes the same distortion. So if the mode that is observed would be a mode of a cavity, then when the detector accelerates, would be the mode that it sees would be a mode of the accelerating cavity. And we don't actually take into account the modes of the cavity, but we take this analogy and we are able to find the transformation of the mode using that analogy. So I'm not going to go into details of the Rinder transformation. I think everybody is perfectly familiar with it. So what I'm going to show you is how we do some simple calculations and how we use the model first to just test it on the simplest example that you can think of. The first question you can ask is whether such a detector is going to see the Unruh effect, whether such a detector is going to extract entanglement when it's accompanied by a second detector that is counter-accelerating in the opposite direction. So these two questions can be answered quite simply with our model. And for that, we consider massless Klein-Gordon fields in Minkowski and Rinder frame of reference. And it is known that the vacuum state of the Minkowski observer corresponds to a two-mode squeeze state of the Rinder vacuum. This S12 operator is just a shortcut for this complicated multimode squeezing of two regions of the Rinder space. And what we do is we introduce a composition of the field operator that we consider into set of Rinder modes that are here denoted with W's. And these Rinder modes live either in the region 1 or in the region 2, and all the composition involves each of them. But we can always introduce an alternative decomposition of the field operator with any set of modes that we like. Here we use Rinder modes, but we could use Hermitian modes, Gaussian modes, whatever complete basis that we have in mind can be always used. In particular, one of the composition would be very useful, namely the composition involving, as one of the elements, the mode of the detector that we consider. So if we denote the mode of the detector with the psi d and the corresponding annihilation operator of d, then there is always possible to make a decomposition into d dagger and everything else. It turns out that everything else is not to be to be very relevant, but you can always complete the whole basis adding new modes so that the whole basis is complete and orthogonal. And for example, you could ask the question, what is the outcome of the measurement of your detector when you measure average number of particles? Or what is the probability of finding n particles in your mode? And the standard answer to that question is just to use the quantum mechanical expressions for average numbers and probabilities. And for example, the average number of particles seen by detector when you repeat many times your experiment is going to be given by Dlugger the average on the state that you observe. Now, the state that you observe depends on the state of motion of the detector. In the Minkowski vacuum, this is going to be just zero. If you observe the Minkowski vacuum from an accelerated frame of reference, however, this state is going to be squeezed Rinder modes, and this mode D will only consist positive Rinder frequencies. So you already see that you can expect some non-zero outcome when you calculate this quantity on this multimode squeeze state in the Rinder accelerated frame. We can also find the expression for probability of finding n particles, and the standard quantum optical expression for that, I think it is goes back to Mandel's photo detection theory, is given by the following expression. It looks a bit more complicated. For those that are not familiar with this expression, this is practically, up to some subtleties, the same with the projection operator onto the and Fox states of the mode V. So practically, what is there is this operator. There are some subtle differences, but I'm not going to go into details. So the probability of finding n particles will be given by the average value of this projection operator. And now we can ask the question how to calculate these things. Now the great advantage of the model that we introduced is that you can calculate all these things very simply, analytically, with no approximations practically, and for arbitrary mode that you choose. And you can study everything on the piece of paper. Well, when you go into details, when you choose one particular function and you want to calculate some integrals, it's good to use some numerics. But you can, big chunk of the whole analysis can be done analytically, and the calculations are really simple. Why is that? This is because what you are going to do is you are going to average to calculate operators like this, or it turns out that this operator is also very simple to calculate, on the states that we consider, in this case, this is a vacuum, it turns out to be not very difficult calculation. However, the vacuum may not be the most interesting example. We will also study two-mode entangled states, and we try to detect it with our detection model. And it turns out that you can also have a very simple analysis of that case, because if you consider two-mode squeeze state, for example, that's entangled, this is a Gaussian state. And all the operators that we calculate are practically quadratic forms of annihilation operators. And it is known that for Gaussian states, they can be completely characterized by so-called covariance matrix that only involves quadratic operators averaged over the state. And these quadratic forms of the operators can be easily evaluated with this model. So let me show you some examples of the calculations. When we calculate the average number of particles on the Minkowski vacuum, when the detector is uniformly accelerated, the whole expression is extremely simple, and it involves the sum over all the Rinder frequencies, where here there's an average number of particles in this two-mode squeeze state in the mode K. And this is actually sine hyperbolic RK. This is the standard expression appearing in the Wunder effect. So this is sine hyperbolic of RK, where RK is related to Rinder frequency via Bose-Einstein distribution. And here we have an overlap of the detector modes with the given Rinder mode. So this is not much more than a Fourier transform of the detector modes written in the Rinder coordinate system. So this can be studied analytically. Also, it turns out that the probability of finding n particles exactly given is exactly related to the average number of particles via this relation. And for those of you that are familiar with quantum optics, this is exactly a thermal distribution. So for a thermal distribution, the relation between average number of particles and the probability of finding n particles is exactly this. And this shows that this uniformly accelerated detector is going to see exactly a thermal distribution of particles. Well, if the distribution is thermal, it's interesting to ask what is the temperature of that state that is being observed. And in order to answer the question, what is the temperature of the state, you not only have to know what is the probability of finding n particles, but you also have to know the energy of transition. Now, this is not so simple, because if you detect a single particle, that corresponds to excitation of a single excitation of this mode psi d that the detector sees. But this mode psi d has not well-defined energy, because it's, for example, a Gaussian wave packet. It doesn't have just one frequency. It has many frequencies. So we can only talk about average energy of that state. There is no unique energy of the mode. And that means that, in principle, you can only calculate something like average temperature, not the real temperature, because the real temperature will have to involve exact energy of the transition. Here we only have average energy, so the temperature is also to be somehow effective temperature. And there is an expression the expression for the temperature can be found using the Bose-Einstein distribution again. And here, this is this average energy that we use for this expression. That involves basically overlap between the mode of the detector and the given Rinder frequency mode, and multiplied by energy of the Rinder mode that is well defined. And for this calculation, we have actually chosen particular type of mode that we take into account. And what we study is the mode that is, as I said, Gaussian. So suppose that we have a detector that is at rest, and we assume that this detector at rest will see exactly this Gaussian mode in Minkowski coordinates. So here there is a Gaussian envelope, and there is an extra phase. This extra phase is actually crucial here, because if we didn't have the phase, then a Gaussian profile with no phase has both contribution from positive and negative frequencies. Fourier transform of a Gaussian is symmetric. That means that it also has both positive and negative frequencies. So in order to shift the Fourier transform in frequency space to the positive values, we have to add this extra phase. And this number n here corresponds to this average energy of the average frequency of the mode in the frequency space. Now, as I said, this is the mode, the shape of the mode in the inertial frame of reference. Oh no, you can hear me better. Better late than never. Sorry. Is it better? So. I have to look down. The question is, what is the mode when you uniformly accelerate? And as I said, you can study this by looking at the behavior of the cavity. And the answer is that all you have to do is you have to replace the Minkowski coordinates with the conformal Rinder coordinates that I have introduced in the Rinder transformation a few slides before. And this is the mode that the detector will see in the uniformly accelerated case. We assume here that the detector is this black box that makes our predictive measurements. It observes one mode, and when we accelerate it, we don't do anything to the detector. We just try to move it, and we do not change the structure or properties of the detector, that means that this transformation from here to here is kind of already imposed by the rules of how modes transform from one frame to the other. In order to calculate all these quantities that I discussed before, like temperature, energy, and probabilities, you have to know the overlap between the function, and the overlap involves Klein-Gordon scalar product. And this Klein-Gordon scalar product not only involves functions itself, but also their derivatives. So you have to specify the function at the time of the measurement and also the derivative. And that's what we assume here. And for those assumptions, it turns out that the temperature that the detector sees is given by this formula. So you could recognize this term here. This term is the Unruh temperature. But it turns out that there is some correction here that makes the result be different from the Unruh temperature. So how is it possible? Why the difference comes from? It turns out that this extra factor here can be most of the time neglected. For example, if accelerations, in the range of parameters that we consider in the whole model, this is most of the time negligible. But in some cases, these corrections will take will be relevant. But it turns out that those corrections appear exactly at the moment when the size of the mode in the frequency space is large. So when the frequency is smeared out, so when the energy of the mode is not well defined. So this always an inevitable consequence of the fact that we take into account detectors that have finite size also in the frequency space. Because when you have a detector that has a finite size, it will never see just a single plane wave. It will see a bunch of frequencies. And therefore, the energy will never be well defined, and therefore, the temperature will never be well defined. So this idealized Unruh temperature will never be able to be detected with a finite size detector or a finite time of measurement. And now we can also study another problem. What happens if you have two counter-accelerating detectors, both going along uniformly accelerated trajectories? And we can try to find what is the entanglement, whether these detectors can detect entanglement present in the field. Because it is well known that there will be some entanglement between right and left Rinder wedges. And in order to calculate this entanglement, it's not enough to know particle number excitations. You have to make some other measurements. So in our scheme, we can replace our single photon counting detector or particle counting detector and replace it with a device that will measure some other observable of the mode that we observe. In this case, it will be very useful to use quadratures. We replace the single counting detector with quadrature detector. That is basically homodyne detector. And I think Kim Ralph will go into many details of this. And we actually can measure quadratures of the modes seen by the two detectors. And we use the following criterion for non-separability of the state detected. And if we apply this criterion to our case, it turns out that we can relate an entanglement estimator with the left-hand side of this equation. And it can be we can study numerically that for those modes that we selected, the entanglement actually increases as a function of acceleration. Actually, the entanglement does not depend only on acceleration. It depends on the product of acceleration and the size of the mode, A times L over C squared. So this dimensionless parameter will parameterize all the results. And we see that the entanglement increases as A times L increases. So you can either increase acceleration or you can increase the size of the detector. Of course, you cannot go as far as you want with that, because at some point your detector will be so large that it will reach the horizon, or it will accelerate so fast that it will reach the horizon and penetrate the horizon. So we only consider those parameters up to values that are not much larger than one or of the order of one. So as you see, this detection technique allows you to study entanglement present in the vacuum state of Minkowski observer. And the more interesting case that we have studied is the case when you have you are observing not a vacuum state, but you observe a two-mode squeeze state. So consider a situation that Alice and Bob, that are inertial, prepare a two-mode squeeze state of two localized modes. Sorry, these are these two modes, phi A and phi B. So Alice and Bob prepares a two-mode squeeze state that has some entanglement in it. And then one of the modes is projectively measured with one of the detectors here by inertial observer, and the other mode is measured by the uniform accelerated observer. Now, as I said, everything can be calculated here analytically, and the whole problem is characterized fully by a covariance matrix of the state that you observe. And this covariance matrix here, I just wrote explicitly not for you to look in detail, but to show you that you can do it actually right on a piece of paper, and it has not that complicated form. So this covariance matrix is fully characterized by alphas, betas, and beta primes, and those things are just overlapped between Alice's mode and detector that detects Alice's mode, and all the overlaps between detectors and the mode that are being observed. So there are these three overlaps. And those three completely characterize the outcomes of your measurements. In particular, you can use this covariance matrix to evaluate entanglement present and observed by the detector. And when you do it, you can find that for various initial squeezings, you will always observe drop of entanglement observed by your detector as, well, I have drawn here, as A times L increases. So A times L is this acceleration and the width of the detector parameter. And if you optimize exactly the Alice's detector to match perfectly the mode that she observes, and you optimize Bob's detector or Rob's detector to match the other entangled modes perfectly at rest, and then you make the detector accelerate, there will be certain mismatch between the two modes due to acceleration, due to motion. There will be also some unruh noise present in the system, and in general the whole state will transform due to Bogoliubov transformation, and all these effects will give rise to this the degradation of entanglement. However, we have found some striking features of those degradation effects, and those will be discussed in detail in the next talk by Jason. I only will tell you some like a teaser of the result. But first of all, it was usually assumed that the noise, unruh noise, will play the dominant role in the degradation effects. And it turns out not to be true. The unruh noise actually, for those realistic localized models of detection, doesn't play much role. It's actually usually negligible. What is crucial for the whole detection and degradation effect is mismatch between the mode that is prepared by Bob and the detector mode of Rob that's accelerating. And we can ask the question, here we have assumed that the detector just accelerates and we do not modify the mode of the detector. But you can ask the question, suppose that Rob that's accelerating wants to compensate the effect of acceleration by changing the properties of the detector. He's still going to assume that his detector has to have only positive frequencies, but maybe we can modify this mode in order to match better the entangled modes prepared by Alice and Bob. And it turns out that this procedure leads to a very serious improvement of the observed entanglement, and I'll just leave the details to be discussed by Jason. And I think I can end here. So just to summarize, we have introduced a model that is actually can be used in many applications. These are just some basic applications for the known cases that have been studied before, and we also have gone beyond and tried to overcome the obstacles and oversimplified assumptions present before in the analysis of the degradation schemes. But we actually want to use this model for more ambitious goals, and we plan to use it for curved space times to apply it for the cases where that has not been studied before, where actually the localization of the detection is relevant and is crucial, and you can discuss protocols like teleportation while exactly knowing where are you teleporting from and where are you teleporting to. And those questions are really relevant, and therefore the localization of the detection procedure has to be well understood. Thank you very much.